Hi, this is Lily DeJoyes Anderson, and you're listening to Choosing Glory. Thanks for joining me this week, and thanks to all new subscribers. Welcome. Today we're talking about Exodus chapters 14 to 17. And we're going to see that in spite of all the miracles that Israel has witnessed, that God has done on their behalf, they are quick to complain. The complaining starts immediately. Let's see what we've got in here. Exodus 14. Let's just take some of the highlights again. Obviously, this is a familiar story, and I hope that you've read it again so that you can review some of these great statements. I'm just going to hit a few highlights. Chapter 14, let's look at verse 11. Here's the complaining that starts even before this last great miracle of the Red Sea. Now, they have seen all the plagues that came upon Egypt, that they were spared of all but those first three plagues, and of course that the lamb's blood put on the doorpost and lintels preserved the lives of their firstborn children. That's an extraordinary deliverance. And they are sent out of Egypt with the spoils of Egypt, where people gave them gold and silver and jewels just to get out. And this great exodus of over 600,000 people, because that's the number of men, and then there are women and children, probably close to 3 million people, leave Egypt because Egypt cannot withstand any more of those plagues. And then, of course, you know, it's astonishing that Pharaoh regrets it. His workers have left. He was building these great treasure cities, right? And now all those workers, that free labor basically, is departing with the spoils of Egypt, and he is angered once again. So he gathers his army and they go after the Israelites. And here again, verse 11 in Exodus 14, they said unto Moses, because there were no graves in Egypt, hast thou taken us away to die in the wilderness? Sarcasm, right? Because there were no graves in Egypt, thou hast taken us away to die in the wilderness. Wherefore hast thou dealt thus with us to carry us forth out of Egypt? In other words, you should have left us there. You should have left us there. In verse 12, is not this the word that we did tell thee in Egypt? Like, didn't we tell you this before we even were set free to go out of Egypt? Let us alone that we may serve the Egyptians, for it had been better for us to serve the Egyptians than that we should die in the wilderness. Verse 13, of course, this powerful statement that Moses makes to the people, fear ye not, stand still and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will show to you today. For the Egyptians whom ye have seen today, ye shall see them again no more forever. Okay, Moses knows what the Lord can do. But the children of Israel have not been converted by these signs and miracles. And that, of course, is a really important theme to remember. We've heard this before, right? That faith does not follow miracles, but miracles follow faith. President Kimball wrote a book called Faith Precedes the Miracle. Moroni in the Book of Ether makes this beautiful statement that the witness comes after the trial of our faith. So in other words, it shouldn't be that surprising, although it still manages to be a little surprising, that after seeing all these amazing miracles, the Israelites still doubt that the Lord has a plan for them and that he will protect them. And of course, Pharaoh doubted it too, right? He sees all those terrible plagues, the loss of his own firstborn child, and his heart still is hardened because he chooses to be bitter and angry and to go after the Israelites. Well, you know how this goes. All are swallowed up in the Red Sea. The Red Sea is divided and the water is like walls on either side. Again, maybe you've reviewed recently the great Cecil B. DeMille movie, The Ten Commandments, and his visualization of this is kind of fun considering that we didn't have CGI back then. You know, they do a pretty good job with special effects and so on. But the Israelites pass through on dry ground, and then here come the Egyptians to follow them into the sea. Can you imagine? Can you imagine the arrogance and the hatred that's driving that? That even seeing this great miracle right in front of them, that through Moses, God has parted the Red Sea for the Israelites, and they chase into the Red Sea after them? That seems like unbelievable arrogance, but you know, there are none so blind as them that will not see. We'll talk more about that later, but some people just will not acknowledge what is before them, things as they really are. God was fighting for Israel, and the Egyptians knew it, and then denied it. So again, signs just do not create belief. Well, there's some interesting archaeological findings about this event underneath the waters of the Red Sea. In 1970, the Egyptian government actually instituted a policy that prohibited the removal of artifacts. And you can understand why they did that. But prior to that, a man named John Wyatt of Wyatt Archaeological Research did some undersea exploration and found a ton of chariot boxes, wheels, axles, as well as human and horse skeletal remains on the seafloor. Later, after that policy was there, they still allowed some undersea exploration. And in 2003, and these were not the only ones, but these are kind of notable expeditions, two brothers, Peter and Mark Elmer of England, did two diving expeditions and found underwater scrapyard that they said was, quote, most definitely the remains of the Egyptian army, unquote. And then a kind of a summary statement that was made by another archaeological researcher in that area, Lennart Möller, and according to Lennart Möller, who was from Stockholm and was the author of The Exodus Case, a book called The Exodus Case, according to this man, human and animal remains and chariot wheels litter Nuweiba Beach. And he said it's clear evidence that Nuweiba Beach is the site of an ancient disaster. As to what that disaster was, the biblical account of God parting the Red Sea found in Exodus 14 is the only reasonable explanation. How else can you explain human and horse skeletal remains and chariot wheels, axles, and boxes, and an 8-spoke Egyptian chariot wheel from the 18th Egyptian dynasty littering the bottom of the Red Sea? I think that's a fair question. Now, again, it's not these kinds of evidences that, you know, really prove anything to the unbelievers. It can strengthen the faith of those of us who already believe to say that, like, hey, once in a while, there is some corresponding archaeological evidence. But it's not about that. If it were just about that, everybody who would read an article on those things would be converted, and that's certainly not the case. God doesn't prove himself to people through that kind of evidence. He wants us to grow in faith. It is a choice. It's a use of our agency to believe or not to believe. And we see things differently when we do believe. And sometimes we miss what's right in front of us when we don't believe. So again, this is really a great example of how miracles do not convert, but the believing can be strengthened by miracles and can be strengthened too, or at least enjoy hearing that sometimes there is some, you know, corroborating evidence of biblical stories in some archaeological research. Now, chapter 15 of Exodus is the celebration after the great deliverance. Let's read the last two verses of chapter 14, verses 30 and 31. Thus the Lord saved Israel that day out of the hand of the Egyptians, and Israel saw the Egyptians dead upon the seashore. Verse 31, and Israel saw that great work which the Lord did upon the Egyptians, and the people feared the Lord and believed the Lord and his servant Moses. But again, just as we've been saying, this momentary conversion to the Lord and to Moses, his prophet, is very short-lived. Just as their, you know, eyewitness of all the plagues that came upon Egypt that allowed them to be freed from the Egyptian slavery, that didn't last very long, because the minute they're backed up against the Red Sea and they see the chariots coming from Pharaoh and his army, they again were like, why didn't you just leave us in Egypt? And we're going to hear that repeated theme as we continue with this record. There's some beautiful verses in this celebration chapter, verse 2 of chapter 15. The Lord is my strength and song, and he has become my salvation. He is my God. That's a beautiful, beautiful celebratory phrase. We should all use that in our minds and hearts. And then verse 6, thy right hand, O Lord, has become glorious in power. Verse 7, and in the greatness of thine excellency, thou hast overthrown them that rose up against thee. Just beautiful celebration here. Verse 11, who is like unto thee, O Lord? Then we see that around verse 20 and so on, the prophetess Miriam takes up a timbrel in her hand and a musical instrument and goes with the women, and they dance and celebrate in that way. And she says in verse 21, "Sing ye to the Lord, for he hath triumphed gloriously. The horse and his rider hath he thrown into the sea." And that's a beautiful phrase, "the horse and his rider hath he thrown into the sea." Some of you may be familiar with this, and of course, most of us are familiar with George Frederick Handel's Messiah, the great oratorio Messiah. Well, he wrote another oratorio that some of you may know called Israel in Egypt. And he has, toward the end of this great chorus with a soprano soloist, and then this great chorus that uses these words right here from Exodus 15, "Sing ye to the Lord, for he hath triumphed gloriously. The horse and his rider hath he thrown into the sea." That's the text that is in that solo and chorus that George Frederick Handel wrote. You might look that up on YouTube if you want to. It's you know, kind of an energetic and exciting part of the oratorio as he's talking about this great deliverance in those words. But then the next verse, verse 22. "So Moses brought Israel from the Red Sea, and they went out into the wilderness of Shur, and they went 3 days in the wilderness and found no water." Okay, 3 days later, "when they came to Marah," verse 23, "they could not drink of the waters of Marah, for they were bitter. Therefore, the name of it was called Marah." In verse 24, "and the people murmured against Moses, saying, what shall we drink?" Now, I mean, you can't blame them for being a little concerned about water for themselves and their cattle and their children. But why the murmuring? Why not just going to the prophet and saying, you know, how should we handle this? What does the Lord want us to do to get water? Remember the comparison here of Nephi? You know, the family is in trouble. They've been in the wilderness for a long time. All the steel bows have broken except for Nephi's. And Nephi's then finally breaks. So they don't have any more steel bows, and they are surviving by hunting what is there around them in the wilderness so that they can survive. And everybody starts to murmur again, and even Lehi and Sariah are concerned and saying, you know, how is this going to work? Like, you sent us out here, and now all those steel bows have broken. And as you know, Nephi makes a bow out of wood, and he strings this bow, makes some arrows, and he goes to his father, and he says, you know, where shall I hunt? And Lehi goes and inquires of the Lord. And Nephi is given directions, and he goes out and he finds food. So that's the pattern, right? When there's trouble, we don't have to start murmuring right away, but that's a very human inclination. It's natural man all the way. To say, like, well, I don't see this, and so I'm going to complain. You know, the prophet must be wrong, or, you know, they've made a mistake, or the church doesn't do this right. It's so quick for people to do that, to murmur when things aren't, you know, perfect. Well, when were they ever perfect on this planet? And I've been thinking about this lately, about how, you know, some people really are pretty unhappy with their lives. And they might be faithful members of the church, but they maybe need to grow their faith a little bit, because they are quick to complain when things don't go well, and they start to feel really unhappy and even bitter about it sometimes. And I was thinking, you know, how is that going to work at the judgment bar? If somebody is, you know, asked by the Lord, you know, were you joyous in living the gospel? Did you see the blessings of living the gospel of Jesus Christ? And if we're sitting there saying, well, my life was really hard, you know, I had these problems and things didn't work out very well and life wasn't fair. And, you know, standing there within our sight might be Joseph Smith and Job and Nephi and Abinadi and all the other great people in this world, known and unknown to us, whose lives were not fair and who had troubles, but they did not murmur. Or if they did for a moment, they quickly restored their faith. And that's okay. We can do that too. We may murmur for a moment, but let's get over it and let's stop it. And let's learn not to murmur, but to go as Nephi did and inquire of the Lord. Okay, what shall I do? Help direct me in what I can do to solve this problem or to, you know, get what my family needs. It's a different approach. And the children of Israel always seem to take the wrong turn on this. Well, there's a nice resolution here where Moses is instructed by the Lord to take a certain tree and cast it into the water, and it turns the bitter waters sweet. Now, there's a great statement, right, about how the Lord makes bitter things into sweet things. I've said this for many years, that if God had a business card, I think it would say, makes lemonade from lemons. Same idea. I remember saying that to somebody in my office many years ago, a man who was having all kinds of problems and had had difficulties in his life. And he kind of looked up when I said that, and he asked, do you really think there's enough NutraSweet in the universe to turn my lemons into lemonade? And, you know, I thought for a moment and gave him my honest belief, which is, oh, yes. Oh, yes. The merciful plan of our Father and the atonement of Jesus Christ have all the sweetness required to turn the bitterest lemons sweet. That's what the Lord can do for us if we don't murmur, but turn to Him in faith. You know, we really need to cut out that murmuring part. It separates us from our faith, and that is not worth it. It's not worth it. There's going to be tough times. We've talked about this again and again. Again, Joseph of Egypt could be right there at the judgment bar with Joseph Smith and Nephi and Abinadi and Job and all those other good guys, because his life too was anything but fair in those that first big season of his life where he's a young adult in slavery and he keeps getting blamed for things that aren't his fault. You know, he could complain too. He could have murmured, but he didn't. He continued faithful so that the Lord could be with him. Well, going on, chapter 16 in Exodus. This time, the children of Israel are hungry. And again, it's a legitimate need for people and their families, but their response is not to inquire of Moses as to what the Lord can do for them or how they should be directed to meet this need, but instead they murmur. And verse 2 of chapter 16, and the whole congregation of the children of Israel murmured against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. Verse 3, and the children of Israel said to him, would to God we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the flesh pots, and when we did eat bread to the full. For ye have brought us forth into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger. How quickly we forget. We're pretty bad that way, aren't we, as a people? You know that. And it's not just the children of Israel. I think sometimes, at least when I was younger, and was becoming familiar with these Old Testament stories and reading through parts of these, I remember thinking, oh, these children of Israel, how could they have been so stiff-necked and hard-hearted and faithless? I mean, when God had done so much for them, how could they possibly be this faithless and unbelieving? But it's not just them. Humankind is not that different. Technology has advanced, but every generation comes into the world needing to demonstrate whether or not they will do the will of the Lord, if they will choose God in the midst of their trials, you know, create Zion in the midst of Babylon, you know, believe when you cannot see. We're all here to do that same thing. So people don't get better generation by generation, just the environment around them is more technologically advanced, if you will. So I hope we will see these people as, you know, the same as people in every generation and make sure that we learn to avoid the problems or the traps that they fell into when they were unbelieving and to do the things that worked when they were believing. Personal story, we had moved to Utah from Las Vegas, and it was a difficult move. I mean, in a way, we had built a new home in Vegas, and not that we didn't have our problems with it. There were some challenges and tests there, too. But it was a lovely place to live. We were in a great ward. The kids all seemed happy with friends and school and so on. And 3 years later, Chris was advanced to a position here as director of the Salt Lake Agency. And we prayed about it because we really were very happy where we were. But we both got a very strong impression that we needed to come to Utah, which surprised us. We had not planned that, and it kind of came out of the blue for us. So, you know, we sold that home and came up. And in some ways, I felt like my ticket to Disneyland had expired, you know. I felt like, wow, I was so happy, except I shouldn't say Disneyland anymore, right? Because we've got some real problems with the Magic Kingdom, right? Nevertheless, we came to Utah and moved into a rental. We had bought property, so we were building a home as owner builders. You know, I'm going to Provo every day from Draper. Chris is going downtown to be the director in Salt Lake. And we were very busy. We had a kid get married a few months later. We didn't really have the network of the resources up here that we would have had in Vegas. But a good friend kind of rescued us in some ways. And then we had kids going on missions. It was a challenging time. And I was asked to substitute for this lesson. this was, you know, 20 plus years ago now, but I was reading through these chapters. And as I read this verse 3 in chapter 16 again, it was, you know, and the children of Israel said unto them, would to God we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt. And I could almost hear myself saying, you know, would to God I had died at the hand of the Lord in Las Vegas, where we sat by the flesh pots. I mean, that even fits, right? The flesh pots of Las Vegas. Not that we went down to the strip, you know. Anyway, we didn't frequent it, that's for sure. But I could really hear the echo in my own soul as I was reading this and thinking about this lesson. And I thought, oh, wow, you know, God is tricky. Here I was, not being very grateful that the hand of the Lord was in our lives because it was hard. And yet, that's the way it goes. I talk about this all the time, that life is going to be hard and there's a purpose to it so that we can grow and become and stretch and become better versions of ourselves. And here I was lamenting that we were not back at the flesh pots of Las Vegas. So again, I was sort of duly chastened, and this helped me to not mournfully look back and wish that the Lord had left us alone or that we had just been able to stay in the condition we were in instead of in another place where there was more growth and more stretching to do. So, of course, God has an answer to their problems, and the answer is in verse 4, Exodus 16, still verse 4. Then said the Lord unto Moses, behold, I will rain bread from heaven for you. I mean, this is amazing stuff. And the people shall go out and gather a certain rate every day that I may prove them whether they will walk in my law or no. So again, there's always an answer. It doesn't mean they didn't get hungry first, but God always has an answer. It's nothing surprises him. There's always a plan. When he makes promises, he keeps them. The hunger is so he can stretch our faith. So give us a chance to, instead of complaining, you know, seek an answer. Again, we talked about Nephi making a bow out of wood and going to his father and saying, where shall I hunt? He didn't just sit down and complain. I want food. He said, what does the Lord want? How are we supposed to stretch in order to have the Lord bless us? And there's just such a different attitude there that I really hope that we can cultivate that. And if it were easy, I say this all the time, if it were easy, everybody would do it. Can I just make that plea again? That these are not easy things, but they are the things that the Lord requires. And it builds us and stretches our faith and deepens our belief in the Lord to stand still and see the salvation of the Lord. The dividing of the Red Sea, same thing. Like, yes, it looks bad right now, but the Lord will keep his promises. Can we hold that thought? I don't know, I hear a lot of sad stories, and life is hard, but I hear about people who, you know, life treats unfairly again, and there could be people involved who treat them unfairly, or just the circumstances of life on a mortal celestial planet. And they're so quick to doubt that God can redeem them. I mean, they've been paying their tithing. They've been paying generous fast offerings. They're temple worthy. They're trying to serve in every way they can. They're being diligent, striving diligently to be obedient children of God. But it's like everything falls apart sometimes, and they think, how can God save us now? Well, has he saved you before? Has he saved his people before? Does he keep his promises? Then stand still and see the salvation of God. There's that great verse in section 123. Remember the last verse there that says, therefore, my beloved brethren, let us cheerfully do all things that lie in our power. Now, note, and then Chris is the one who pointed this out to me that I really like. He said, that word cheerfully is important. He said, if we can't do it cheerfully, maybe we're trying to do too much, or maybe we just have to adjust our attitude. But God is very clear here. Let us cheerfully do all things. And what does that mean? With faith. Cheerfully, because we know God will keep his promises. So we're going to do what we can do first, which is always required. Cheerfully do all things that lie in our power, and then may we stand still with the utmost assurance to see the salvation of God and for his arm to be revealed. Same message there at the banks of the Red Sea and right here in section 123, because the message never changes. It's always this way. It's always do what you can cheerfully and then trust that the Lord will reveal his arm and salvation will come in his time and his way, which is always better than our time and our way. I mean, we might think we have a really good plan. His plan is better. Just saying. His plan is always better because he is thinking of who we are and who we can be. And that's what he's invested in, is helping us, if we choose, allow him to make of us what we can be. Manna, as you know, was there with them for 40 years in the wilderness every day. They were not to pick it up on the Sabbath day. And if they tried to keep it, it would turn gross and stinky, right? But nevertheless, some tried to keep it. Again, they still didn't trust God. And there aren't enough miracles anywhere in all time to convince people who don't choose to believe. And we have so many people who are basically looking for a sign. You know, prove to me the archaeological evidence of the Book of Mormon. Prove to me this. Prove to me that. And it's like, no. No, God is testing us to see if we choose to believe a God of truth, a God of love and of mercy, who has done everything for us and will do everything for his righteous believers. So it doesn't work that way. We have to exercise the faith first. We recognize this, right? But it is kind of funny that they tried to store the manna anyway. I mean, funny in a kind of pathetic way. Let me be clear. It's not hilarious. It's just ridiculous that they still didn't trust God, because they didn't choose to trust him. They didn't stretch their faith through choice and intention. I remember seeing a truck that kind of was hedging its bets in that same way as these people were trying to, you know, store the manna. The truck had two bumper stickers on its back window. One of them said, "God is my co-pilot." And on the other side, it said, "This truck insured by Smith and Wesson." So I thought that was kind of funny that, you know, this guy's hedging his bets too. And these people are always trying to hedge their bets. It's like, okay, God is providing us with bread from heaven that we just go out and pick up every day, but maybe he's not going to do it tomorrow. So we better save some, even though he said not to save some. That's really very tragic. It's really very tragic. Why are we trying to hedge our bets? I mean, it really does have to be this kind of all-in situation with the Lord. We either believe him or we don't. Well, I should mention, but you know this, it shows us in the footnote that the manna is the word for what is it, which makes a lot of sense. Something that had never been seen before and would never be seen again, at least not till this time in the history of the world, that God provided, he rained down bread from heaven to provide sustenance for the children of Israel, as he had promised. And he will for us, as he has promised. The next problem, of course, is the trouble with water. So in verse 2 of chapter 17, "Wherefore the people did chide with Moses and said, 'Give us water that we may drink.' And Moses said unto them, 'Why chide ye with me? Wherefore do ye tempt the Lord?'" Again, why are you so upset? Why are you murmuring? Again, this is the Laman and Lemuel pattern instead of the Nephi pattern, where it's like, what shall we do? Because I will do it. I'll do what the Lord commands, because I know he'll keep promises. Anyway, trying to beat that drum. Why do you tempt the Lord? And verse 3, "The people thirsted there for water, and the people murmured against Moses and said, 'Wherefore is this that thou hast brought us up out of Egypt?'" Have we heard this before? "To kill us and our children and our cattle with thirst." Same thing. "Why didn't you leave us by the flesh pots of Las Vegas?" Well, I repented of that, just so you know. "And Moses cried unto the Lord, saying, 'What shall I do unto this people? They be almost ready to stone me.'" So again, this is not just your average complaint. You know, they really lose their faith, if they have any, in a heartbeat. If they can't see it, they don't believe. Not even to go 24 hours until the next morning when God rains down heaven on the earth. I mean, think about it. But not with a way of looking at them and saying, we're much better. It's a way of looking at ourselves and saying, where are the areas where I don't trust the Lord? I sort of trust him when things are going well. But when things start to go badly, I don't trust him anymore. I panic. I'm scared. I'm afraid. Because I haven't really learned to trust him in the grip of trouble. And that's what happens here again and again. Have we learned that? Have we learned not to panic when there's a problem, a crisis that we don't see the answer to or the resolution for? But that's the point, to believe when we can't see. So let us look at ourselves and learn from this example that we be not like the children of Israel. And when disaster strikes, which it does, that we trust that the Lord has a plan for us, and that if we are striving diligently to keep our covenants, he has deliverance prepared for us in his time and in his way, which is much better than our time and our way. And here's the question Again, in verse 7, that it tells us that Moses called this place by certain names because of the children of Israel, because they tempted, skipping to the end, because they tempted the Lord, saying, is the Lord among us or not? And why do we have the right to challenge the Lord when he has said, we are his people? We are covenant people of the Lord. So again, please, let's look in the mirror and say, are there times where things don't work out well for me and I am so quick to then think, is the Lord with me or not? Is the Lord going to keep his promises? Where has he gone? Why did this happen? Why hasn't he protected me from this? But the whole point is so that we can stretch, so that we can demonstrate that our faith is becoming tempered. And when tough things happen, it does not shake our faith. That's the whole point. Then in verse 8, we have the beginning of this battle with Amalek. So here come the Amalekites, and they fight with Israel in this place. And Moses calls Joshua to choose out men and go and fight with Amalek tomorrow. This is verse 9 of Exodus 17. I will stand on the top of the hill with the rod of God in mine hand. And then we have this kind of interesting story where Joshua does what Moses tells him to do and fights with Amalek. And Moses, Aaron, and Hur go up to the top of the hill. And it came to pass that when Moses, this is verse 11 now, and it came to pass when Moses held up his hand that Israel prevailed. And when he let down his hand, Amalek prevailed. Now, why would that happen? It's just another way that the Lord is gently and kindly, well, I should say patiently, working with the children of Israel. Do you see that I have called Moses to be the prophet, that he is speaking for me, and he is the leader that I have chosen for this time in this great exodus from Egypt to return into Israel? So Moses lifts his arm, and the Israelites are winning, and if he drops his arms, then Amalek starts to win. In verse 12, Moses' hands were heavy, and they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat thereon, and Aaron and Hur stayed up his hands, the one on the one side and the other on the other side, and his hands were steady until the going down of the sun. In verse 13, and Joshua discomfited Amalek, which obviously means weakened, it says in the footnote here, or disabled. In other words, Israel prevailed in this great battle. And then the Lord says to Moses to write this in a memorial, in a book. But okay, so this is a cool story to me too, but it's also just that I think God is showing another clear sustaining of his prophet Moses, that he is with Moses and Moses is with him. And he's showing this in another way to the children of Israel. Doesn't take, let's face it, the children of Israel have a long history even coming up here of faithlessness. Now, there are some people in Israel who stand forth with shining, bright faith. And that's the point for God, because he doesn't care if it's one or 1,000. The one matters to God, and he will do what he does in order for however few to be refined and choose God and qualify for the kingdom. So it doesn't matter what people are doing around us, in or out of the covenant people. It's about what we choose to do. Do we choose to be refined, or are we stuck in our same stubborn ways where we don't grow, we don't change, we don't let ourselves be taught of the Lord and of the Spirit? There are really important lessons to learn from these people. And it doesn't work too well if we don't look in the mirror and just change it to our day and see what choices we're making. Is our strength growing and tempering and becoming shining bright so that no matter what happens, we never fail to trust in the Lord? And that's a process, but you know, let's get on with it. Let's build it. If we are going to be Zion builders, we need to have that kind of tempered faith that doesn't fail no matter who's coming after us. The Egyptian army, the Red Sea, the Lamanites, you know, whatever, pandemics, plagues, whatever it is. You know, let us not let our faith fail. Let us grow our faith. And even when we cannot see, let us believe. I have a friend who has a visible back patio that is kind of overseas, an area where a lot of the public are. And she occasionally puts inspirational signs on her patio. And during the pandemic, she had a sign that was, I thought, beautiful. She said, "Quarantine your fears," which was such a nice turn of phrase. And that's what all of us should do. We don't fear during these times. That's not useful. It never makes sense to act in fear or make decisions based on fear. What have we to fear when the Lord is on our side? Death is not the enemy. Sin is the enemy. If we've chosen to be on the Lord's side, we don't have to worry about death. We don't have to worry about unrepented sins. So, you know, we can quarantine our fears. We can grow and become through the difficulties of our life. That's the whole point, is to grow, not to be stopped, not to be thrown down from our life's journey, but to be strengthened, to become even a better version of ourselves. So let's do a few takeaways from these chapters. And there are so many. I'm just going to choose a few. Is it a day of miracles? Sometimes people ask, well, you know, we are not dividing the Red Sea right now. And, you know, we don't have these plagues that afflict our enemies. And we're not getting manna in the wilderness. Well, a dear friend that I taught seminary with in Las Vegas many years ago, I loved his answer to his students when they asked about, is this a day of miracles? Why aren't they doing the miracles now that were done in the Old Testament, and especially at this time? And my friend very wisely said, oh, you don't think there are miracles today? He said, well, let's see. A 14-year-old boy walked into a grove of trees and knelt down to ask for clarification and saw the Father and the Son. And then the heavens opened wide and an angel directed him to an ancient record carved on gold plates. And through the gift and power of the Holy Ghost, he translated them into the most perfect book on earth. I mean, he went on, but I thought, yeah, that was a pretty good response. It's true. What are we saying? It's not an age of miracles? Yes, miracles have happened ever since the restoration of the gospel in amazing ways. There are members of the church in every country on the planet. We may not have missionaries in every country. We have members in every country on earth. I'm just naming a few. There are so many amazing miracles. Temples dot the earth. I looked this up because it changes all the time, right? We have 164 dedicated and operating temples, or that are scheduled for dedication or rededication soon. 164 that are completed. That's extraordinary. I grew up in a time where there were 12. There were 12 temples. We knew where they all were. It's an amazing, miraculous time. And just to add this fun little tidbit, there are 265 temples in various stages of operation, renovation, construction, or planning. So 265 temples we're going to have here in the next few years. This is extraordinary. It is an age of miracles. I'll share one of the other miracles that is a story by Boyd K. Packer that I think is really sweet. He told this story in 2011 to an auditorium filled with LDS military chaplains and their wives. So these are chaplains for all our military branches that are Latter-day Saint chaplains, and they were in a meeting with their wives. Boyd K. Packer came to speak to them in 2011. The auditorium is filled. And he told them that about 50 years prior to that time, the entire chaplain corps of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints had shrunk down to 5 or 6 men. 5 or 6 in all the branches of military service. There were only about 5 or 6 Latter-day Saint chaplains. Now, why? Well, because after World War II in Korea, with the Vietnam War coming up, the Department of Defense had changed the requirements for chaplains. And they would not certify any chaplains to serve in the military unless they had at least 90 semester hours in an accredited university seminary, in other words, a ministerial college. And that meant basically that they were ordained ministers in a church, either the Catholic Church or one of the Protestant churches. Of course, as you know, we don't have an ordained ministry. We have a lay ministry. So as chaplains got older or fulfilled their military service and whatever and left the military, we couldn't have any new chaplains to replace them. So we were down to like 5 or 6. And this was a serious problem for the church, which wants to support its military members with Latter-day Saint chaplains in the different corps. So Boyd K. Packer at the time was an assistant to the 12 apostles. That was before we changed out everything to 70s, as you may remember. So he was an assistant to the 12, and he had only been that for about 3 years. So he was a fairly new general authority. Harold B. Lee, who was a senior apostle at that time, later to be president of the church, sat on some boards of fairly prestigious businesses back east, and he tried to use some of that influence to kind of, you know, make a case to the Defense Department that LDS chaplains should be ordained regardless of not being ordained ministers because of the way our church is different, but to no avail, so nothing was working. And Boyd K. Packer was actually at the time on the church's military committee, so he was called out of a meeting one day and told that he would be meeting with the President of the United States, who was Lyndon Baines Johnson, the following day. So it was kind of a last-minute assignment. And he left the next day to fly to Washington and have that prearranged meeting with President Johnson. And on his way out, he stopped to see Harold B. Lee and asked if Brother Lee had any counsel for him. And I love this answer. So Harold B. Lee looked at Boyd K. Packer and said, "Yes, I do. Just remember, this is an 1830, and there aren't just six of us anymore." Let me say that again. "Yes, I do. Just remember, this is an 1830, and there aren't just six of us anymore." So, of course, he's referring to April 6th, 1830, when the church was organized with six official members that first day. And what a wonderful reminder. And Boyd K. Packer's telling the story and saying, well, that's true. That's true. We have millions in the church now, and we need to be represented with chaplains in the military. So he felt some empowerment from that good counsel. He went in to talk to President Johnson, who called Cyrus Vance, who was the Secretary of Defense at that time, and on the phone basically said, "You know, I'm going to send this young man over there, and I want you to give him what he's asking for." And apparently there was some sort of protest from Secretary Vance on the phone. And he said, "Oh, come on, Cyrus." This is President Johnson speaking. "Oh, come on, Cyrus. These Mormons have their kids preaching and praying from their mother's knees." In other words, you know, arguing that they shouldn't have to go to this ministerial seminary or for all those hours to be able to be serve as chaplains in the military when they come from our church. So that was kind of a sweet little story about how the Lord has worked miracles. We started with six people in 1830. And look at the growth of the church. Yes, it's still, relatively speaking, you know, a small movement worldwide. But what power has come through in the ministry of the church on earth? Members in every country, temples all over the globe, a missionary program that isn't just designed to share the gospel and gather Israel and baptize people into the covenant, but also to help our young men and women become better capable of serving in the church, of being good husbands, good wives, good mothers, good fathers, good community members, good member missionaries. Such miracles are occurring every day in the church. Our God is clearly a God of miracles. But remember that deliverance comes in His time and His way. You know, as a counselor, I see a lot of people in tough situations that they have no control over, where other people or messed up judicial system or other situations impose difficulties on them that they did not create for themselves. Maybe they've gone through a bad divorce and the custody determination was not what it should be considering the behavior of the parents. And nevertheless, these things now are written in a decree, so people limp along in difficult circumstances where they may see their children go into very difficult circumstances and wonder why the Lord hasn't fixed that or why He allowed it to happen in the first place. But as I continue to work with people in whatever situation, it is remarkable to see that those who choose to believe that the deliverance will come in the Lord's way and in His time and are content to wait upon the Lord, not to just wait, but to wait upon the Lord, it's amazing to see how their faith grows, how they start to notice the miracles that the Lord does for them, how they see these tender mercies and sometimes much greater acts by the hand of the Lord to make small deliverances or sometimes larger deliverances in different arenas. When, yes, of course, their first choice would have been to say, you know, "Lord, can you just fix this situation?" But instead, He lets it fix them if they are willing. If to their broken heart they add a contrite spirit, the miracle that really happens is the change, the refinement that comes in their own lives and that is promised to their children in the right day. And again, it's like let us not be so impatient that we don't wait or stand back to see the hand of the Lord revealed, that we don't cheerfully do what lies in our power and then again stand still with the utmost assurance to see the hand of the Lord revealed and his promises fulfilled. Impatience gets us in a lot of trouble, certainly gets these children of Israel into problems again and again where they're ready to throw Moses under the bus, who has done so many great things through the power of God that he holds. And our impatience can get us into trouble too. Not if we choose faith, not if we stretch our patience, we stretch our faith, and we choose to allow God to work in us his miracles. And deliverance will come. He has promised an end to injustice. He has promised an end to pain and to worry and to sorrow. Can we believe him? We should believe him because he always tells the truth. Can we find it in ourselves to stretch our faith over these areas of trouble, these areas that are not resolved, these areas where we can't even see a resolution with our earthly eyes? But God has promised deliverance, and he keeps his promises. There are so many great places to go with a topic like this one. Here are just a few. Turn with me to Ether chapter 12, or just listen to these great verses, starting with verse 3. And this is speaking of the prophet Ether, who is exhorting the Jaredites. And remember, the Jaredites are ripening in iniquity, and pretty soon they're going to destroy each other and themselves. Ether is still petitioning to them to turn unto the Lord and be saved. And look at these words about Ether. Verse 3 of chapter 12 in Ether. For he did cry from the morning even until the going down of the sun, exhorting the people to believe in God and to repentance, lest they should be destroyed, saying unto them, that by faith all things are fulfilled. I've been talking about that. Verse 4, wherefore whoso believeth in God might with surety hope for a better world, yea, even a place at the right hand of God, which hope cometh of faith, maketh an anchor to the souls of men. I've always loved that phrase, an anchor to the souls of men, as a definition of hope. Going on with verse 4, which would make them sure and steadfast. I have a friend who says that her favorite word in all scripture is steadfast. I love that too. Always abounding in good works, being led to glorify God. You see the progression there. That if you believe in God, then you can have a sure hope, even a hope of a place at the right hand of God. And that hope comes from faith and makes an anchor for our souls, that makes us sure and steadfast, abounding in good works, being led to glorify God. Of course, that's where it would end up, that we would glorify the great God whose plan this is and his son, Jesus Christ, who has given it life. And then verse 5, and it came to pass that Ether did prophesy great and marvelous things, even miracles, right? Unto the people, which they did not believe because they saw them not. Let me read that again. He prophesied great and marvelous things unto the people, which they did not believe because they saw them not. But remember, we are supposed to believe even when we don't see. Otherwise, what separates us from Babylon? What separates us from the world? How are we going to be different unless we stretch our belief to believe when we cannot see? I've said it before, there are some kinds of faith that can only grow in the dark or in the valley of the shadow. That is where faith can take giant leaps forward, because we can't see, and yet we choose to believe. So what a tragedy. Now, you know that Moroni is editing this. He adds this to his father's record before adding a few chapters of his own book to complete the Book of Mormon. And that's why the Jaredite story is basically the end of the Book of Mormon, even though it happened much earlier, because it's a separate set of plates that Moroni is inspired to add to his father's record before closing the record with his own testimony. So Moroni then goes and gives this wonderful discourse on faith in this chapter, Ether 12, which many of you will remember has beautiful statements about faith, always worth a review when we're trying to stretch our faith or any other time. But it is this business of being able to see. So then that reminded me of a speech that many of you know and love called Stand Forever, given by Elder Lawrence Corbridge at BYU in January of 2019. This is toward the end of a speech. It's really a wonderful speech, but I'm just going to read this little part. The healing of the withered hand is not nearly as amazing as the existence of the hand in the first place. Now, you see what he's saying? He's saying we look for these miracles that are going to be like astonishing or whatever, but he's saying the healing of that withered hand isn't nearly as amazing as the fact that the hand exists in the first place, that the Creator gave us a hand that has so much incredible function. Going on with Corbridge's speech, if it exists, it follows that it can certainly be fixed when it is broken. The greater event is not in its healing, but in its creation. More phenomenal than resurrection is birth. The greater wonder is not that life, having once existed, could come again, but that it ever exists at all. More amazing than raising the dead is that we live at all. A silent heart that beats again is not nearly as amazing as the heart that beats within your breast right now. That one could see on a stone or through a special lens the modern translation of ancient text written on plates of gold is far less amazing than the human eye. The wonder is not what the human eye may see, rather that it sees anything at all. How can you believe in extraordinary things such as angels and gold plates and your divine potential? Easy. Just look around and believe. I think that's a beautiful treatment of faith, another way to look at that and stretch our faith. Then, of course, is this wonderful verse that it reminded me of in Alma chapter 30. And I have loved this verse since I was a teenager. This is Alma speaking to Korihor. And Korihor, is debating him. So the two of them are talking. And in verse 43 of Alma 30, "And now Korihor said unto Alma, if thou wilt show me a sign, that I may be convinced that there is a God, yea, show unto me that he hath power, and then will I be convinced of the truth of thy words." There it is again. Why tempt ye God, right? Verse 44, "But Alma said unto him, thou hast had signs enough. Will ye tempt your God? Will ye say, show unto me a sign, when ye have the testimony of all these brethren, and also all the holy prophets? The scriptures are laid before thee, yea," and here's the phrase that I came to love so much, even in my youth, "all things denote there is a God." I'm going to say that again. "All things denote there is a God. Yea, even the earth and all things that are upon the face of it. Yea, and its motion. Yea, and also all the planets which move in their regular form do witness that there is a supreme creator." I love that. If we have only the eyes to see, then everything witnesses of God. Of course, we know that one of the apostles after the resurrection of Christ did not believe the reports of his resurrection. And Jesus appeared unto Thomas and said, "Thomas, because thou hast seen me, thou hast believed. Blessed are they that have not seen and yet have believed." Again, the contrast. Believing after seeing is one thing, but believing when we cannot see is the goal. That's what strengthens our faith. That's what eventually will move mountains or heal the sick or raise the dead, when it is God's will that that be done through his power. Choose to believe. Choose to see. Choose glory. This is how we qualify for higher levels of glory. If we want to be in a celestial kingdom, we need to stretch our faith to a celestial level. Every day, we can choose that glory by choosing to believe in the midst of trouble, in the midst of pain, in the midst of darkness or blindness, or just not being able to see the future. Brothers and sisters, we can believe. And in doing so, we get a little closer to qualifying to build Zion. That is our task. I appreciate all of you who've joined me on Patreon for that extra content, and I invite more of you to join us. That will really help me continue with this podcast. Go to Patreon, patreon.com/choosingglory, and it will give you some options to subscribe and support this effort. Thank you for joining me. I want to give special thanks to my husband, Chris Anderson, and to Doug Larson of Point Digital. Take care.